Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. Today, I have the privilege of sitting down with Brynn. I invited Brynn to Venus Rising because she is featured in our new documentary titled Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? Brynn's daughter, now 16 years old, began to identify as trans at the age of 13 and is still rejecting her female body. Brynn wants her daughter to embrace her female body and to protect her from a medical pathway that she might later regret. Brynn's daughter is just one of many girls suffering from rapid onset gender dysphoria. Brynn advocates for whole, healthy bodies, acceptance of different personality expressions, eliminating harmful gender stereotypes, and standing up for women and children's privacy and safety. Brynn works with nonprofits that seek to raise funds for public education in regards to the harms and abuse that trans-identifying people and their families suffer in the medical and mental health community. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your week to join us on Venus Rising.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoyed the time that I got to spend with you on the set of our documentary, Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? And this documentary is specifically focused on medically transitioning young children. And when you shared with us your story that day, the whole time I just kept thinking, here's a mom simply trying to protect and provide for her daughter the best way she knows how. And I think a lot of listeners can sympathize with that. So do you mind by starting by telling us briefly about the day your daughter came to you to tell you that she wanted to be or that she felt like a boy? And did she use those words? What was your reaction?
So she didn't really come to me to tell me. At the time, she had a cell phone and she would text message with her friends. And I had an app on my phone that would allow me to, you know, see the conversations that she was having. You know, it's very important. We want to keep our kids safe from things. Teenagers are apt to get in trouble. And I was checking through the app that I had of the messages she was sending. And I noticed she was having a conversation with a young girl that she's friends with. And both of them were having a conversation as though they were both boys and that they were having a very age inappropriate conversation with one another. And at that point, I went to question her about it. And when I questioned her about these inappropriate messages is when I found out that she had, with this other friend of hers, had started to identify herself as a teenage boy instead of a teenage girl.
What was your relationship like with your daughter prior to finding this?
Our relationship had always been very close. My daughter and I, you know, a lot of times people will call her my mini me. We're very much alike in a lot of ways. We're also very, very different in other ways. But we had always had a very strong, close bond as far as I was concerned. I felt that I had a much closer, stronger relationship with her than a lot of her peers had with their parents. And I've always been very open and very accepting, very loving, very caring. So when she came to me with this and I was not as accepting as I think she might have expected, it really started to drive a wedge between the two of us.
So when you found this on her phone and this relationship, what was your gut reaction? What happened next?
So first, I made it very clear to her that she would not be able to continue spending the kind of time that she had been spending with this friend. I feel, especially with teenagers, once you've crossed sort of a sexual boundary, it's very hard to go back to just being friends. So that was one of the first things that we addressed. And, you know, I had a not so emotionally controlled conversation with her about why she thought she was a boy. For me, this was just completely out of the blue. She was not a person who ever was any level of gender nonconforming, really, as a young girl. I mean, she might wear things that might typically be associated as boys' clothing on occasion, but it wasn't something that she was drawn towards. She was definitely drawn more towards things that would be considered girls' clothing. You know, case in point, if we were going to the grocery store, she might wear a Rapunzel dress. I mean, she was just very stereotypically girly up until this moment in time. And when I asked her why it was she thought she was a boy, she gave me, you know, a lot of those circular answers that you hear. You know, it's a feeling that she has. It's her authentic self. Why can't I accept this? And I tried very diligently to express to her that what I really felt was happening is that she was having some sort of mental or emotional complication that we needed to address maybe through talk therapy. I myself am a survivor of anorexia. It's been a lot of years since I had any eating disorder tendencies, but I know that I got really good mental health care when I had similar emotions. I thought that I was a much bigger person than I really was. And I see a lot of parallels between this one mental health crisis and this other mental health crisis. So I approached it in a way that I feel it was approached to me when my family discovered I had an eating disorder, and started to figure out very quickly that that's not the approach anymore. And when I told her that I thought that what she was dealing with was more of a mental health issue, she told me that all the things that I was saying made this seem so ugly, but this was so beautiful to her and I was making her feel ugly.
So how did you decide to support her? Did you guys get into a therapist? What was the journey there?
My first phone call was to our pediatrician, who said to me, get her in counseling. So I said, sure thing. I mean, I've relied on our pediatrician. She was the pediatrician for the family I nannied for before I ever had my own children. So I've known this pediatrician a very long time, you know, 20 years now. And so I trusted her instincts, find a counselor. And I started looking for a counselor, and I would call and I would ask questions. And I would have most counselors tell me over the phone, sight unseen, that if my daughter said that she was my son, then he was my son. And that was very terrifying to me, without ever meeting this child, that they could come to this decision so quickly, when I feel that I definitely know my child really well. I don't think that I'm the kind of parent who thinks, oh, my kid's such a good kid, even though they're like half rotten. I feel like I've spent a lot of time getting to know my child. I mean, she's one of two people in this whole wide world who's ever heard my heartbeat from the inside. We know each other very well. And I feel that I'm allowed to weigh in when we're talking about something that looks an awful lot like a lot of other social contagions that teenage girls have dealt with throughout history. And most of these therapists did not agree. It took me almost 9 months to find a counselor that seemed safe. And that counselor was exorbitantly expensive, was not covered under insurance, cost me a lot of money out of pocket to see this woman. But thankfully, she was not willing to perform what people might consider conversion therapy. And that's not what I was looking for. But I think maybe some parents in my situation maybe are desperate, and maybe that's what they think they're looking for. But she was not also an outright, instantly affirming counselor either. So my daughter was able to get to some of the roots of some of the things that were going on for her emotionally and mentally when working with this counselor. But the cost was so much that it wasn't sustainable for me. So we had to find another counselor. And we did. We found a really lovely counselor who was just amazing. And my daughter and I really repaired a lot of our relationship during our first few sessions with the second counselor. But I think that my daughter became very frustrated that this counselor and the previous counselor weren't willing to say, hey, we believe you have gender dysphoria, and we believe that we should, you know, get you to an endocrinologist to talk about hormones, because she was really, really stuck that was the next step for her. She wanted the next step to be hormones. And she grew bored of the second counselor, and we are now on our third counselor. And then it's not easy. This second counselor took insurance, which was great. This current counselor does not, but she does have us on a sliding scale fee, which is nice. She is not outright affirming, but she also has her pronouns in her email closure. So it's difficult to gauge. My daughter has made some significant progress with her about a lot of her mental health concerns. She still has not, she does not accept herself as a female. So it's a work in progress for sure.
Sounds like you support her regardless though. You know, I feel like as an adult now, I was also in counseling as a child, and I didn't realize how hard it is for parents to find the time, the money, the resources to, and it's important. I'm not saying that my mother didn't find that important or that you don't, but it is a sacrifice. So I hope she appreciates that from you, you know? So talking about the pronouns, there are some physicians who state that there isn't any harm using those gender-confirming names or pronouns. What are your thoughts on that? Did you or do you call your daughter by her preferred name and pronouns?
I do not. I have the second counselor that we had was the first person that we addressed this with out loud together. And she basically helped us come to a compromise wherein if my daughter's friends wanted to call her by her boy name and her boy pronouns, that should be okay, because oftentimes kids do have nicknames, you know, that are different than the names that their parents give them. And some parents are willing to go along with the nickname and some parents aren't. And I'm just one of those parents who isn't. So we sort of had a deal, as long as, you know, it was friends, family, whomever else was comfortable, that was okay. But, you know, I, as mom, I'm not there. And I don't know that I'll ever be there. I'm not sure that that's a goal that I would ever work toward. I did make it very clear to her that if in her 20s or 30s, if she does go through some level of medical intervention and what people see when we're out in public looks like a young man and somebody calls her sir, I'm not going to freak out and say, no, that's my daughter. You know, that's my little girl or whatever. You know, I don't want to confuse anybody else either. So, you know, I feel that as her mom, though, I get to retain some level of rights, and I'm sorry you don't love your chosen name, but I did choose it for you, and I'm not ready to give it up. So
you found out that in school, the teachers had started calling your daughter by her new name and using those male pronouns without your knowledge. How did that make you feel? How did you find that out?
I spiraled a little bit because we were at the pediatrician's office for an ADD evaluation, and I had these packets that they sent to the family and to my daughter and to her teachers so that we could all go through and sort of do an evaluation of how well she pays attention and the things she does pay attention to, and when we just different things to make sure everybody was kind of on the same page. You know, they go through a very extensive evaluation for children that may or may not have attention deficit disorder. And I think they might even call it attention deficit hyperactivity disorder now. Please don't hold me to that, because okay. I always get it backwards one way or the other. But it's a very extensive process. You have to like be evaluated basically by your family, your peers, your teachers, the people who know you best, that see you the most. And I had asked them all, please, can you get this packet back to me by such and such date? Because my daughter has an appointment with her pediatrician. And so they did, most of them, get the packets back in time. And we were sitting in the pediatrician's waiting room and I had them all. And I just read through them as we were sitting there. And I started realizing that even though I had put her given name on the forms, they were all writing her boy name on the forms and they were using male pronouns. And this is right before we're going in to meet with the pediatrician. And I had had a little bit of a falling out with the pediatrician a few months prior. I had taken my son for an appointment for something else. And the pediatrician asked me, you know, did you ever get your daughter a counselor? And I said, I did finally. Thank you. I said, it took me 9 months to find somebody that wasn't willing to like affirm her over the phone sight unseen. But we did finally find somebody and it seems to be working really well for both of us. And the pediatrician says, well, you know, she's not wrong. I said, I'm sorry. She said, you know, your daughter, she's not wrong. These feelings don't come out of nowhere. And I said, she's not wrong about what? She said, well, being a boy. And I said, okay, well, with all due respect, we might just have to agree to disagree. You know, because here, I didn't even know until that moment that she felt differently about this than I did. And here we're talking about a very highly educated medical professional who knows very well the difference between boys and girls, especially as a pediatrician. And, you know, and I think I'd even said to her at the time, I said, you know, we've known that she was a girl since the moment they put the Doppler on over my uterus and we were able to see her uterus inside of my uterus while I was pregnant with her. She's been a girl since before she was born. She'll be a girl forever. And that was, I think, when the pediatrician said something different. And I said, we'll just have to agree to disagree. So we'd already had this sort of like mini confrontation prior to the ADD evaluation appointment. So I had really had myself prepared, like in my head, I sort of like pre-gamed it, you know. I was like, okay, I'm just gonna be calm and cool and collected, and I'm going to answer the questions, and I'm going to advocate for my child, but it's not going to turn into a thing. I'm not going to let this turn into a thing. But when the pediatrician came in the room, oh no, I'm sorry. Let me back up. So I'm sitting in this waiting room waiting for this appointment, and I have these forms, and I'm realizing that all of her teachers are using her boy name and her pronouns. And I'm imagining now what the dynamic's going to be when we finally get into the pediatrician's office with my daughter there. I mean, the last time we had this little confrontation, my daughter wasn't there. So my thought and my hope was, okay, well, hopefully if she wants to talk to me about this, she'll take me out of the room, or we'll figure it out. But I just didn't want it to turn into a situation in front of my daughter. But now I'm reading this form and I'm getting really upset. And when the pediatrician did call us back, one of the first things she asked my daughter, she says, you know, how are you? I haven't seen you in a while. And then she says, oh, do you want me to call you your name, or do you want me to call you your boy name? I'm pretty sure that was how she worded it. And my daughter says, well, you know, it makes my mom uncomfortable, so, you know, you can call me my birth name. And I said, well, no. I said, the pediatrician asked you what you would like her to do. So, you know, I'm okay with the pediatrician calling you your boy name. I just prefer not to do it, you know, because I want to give, I mean, at this point, my daughter, I think she's 15 at this appointment, and she's getting to a point where she's going to have to start making some decisions for herself. You know, even in that appointment, they offered the Gardasil shot, and I didn't speak for my daughter. I said, you know, is it something you're interested in getting? She said, I'm not really sure that I know enough about it. So we asked for the packet insert so we could go home and we could read it together, and she could decide for herself if that was in fact a vaccination she wanted to have. So I'm trying to give her a little bit more control and autonomy in her life, because she's getting ready to be a whole ass adult soon, you know?
Yeah.
So when the pediatrician asked that question, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't speaking over my child and speaking for her. I wanted her to be able to answer the question, whether we agree on the situation or not. I think it's important that, you know, she addressed what the doctor asked her, not necessarily how I'm feeling about some. But then I go through that whole speech about it, and so they decide that the boy name is fine. But then the pediatrician asks about pronouns, and I'm not sure why there's such a hard line for me between pronouns and this nickname, other than, again, a nickname is a nickname. But when you're trying to change reality to that degree, that I'm looking at a child that I know is female and you want to apply male pronouns, I just can't bridge that disconnect. Mm-hmm. And to watch other people do it is maddening, you know, because you know that they're not telling the truth, and it's not kind to lie. So I have a very hard time with this. And so when the pediatrician asked, I said, oh no, I'm sorry. I'm not there. I'm not ready. We're not doing pronouns. And the pediatrician got really upset, and she like slams her, she had like a laptop and like a notepad, puts it down on the counter, and she says, you know, basically I'm being difficult. I remind her of her mother-in-law, and you know, we kind of have a little bit of back and forth. And I said, well, it sounds like your mother-in-law is a very wise woman then, you know. And she says, well, that's how she felt until my niece almost killed herself because of her dysphoria.
And your daughter's in the room this whole time.
In the room, like right behind me, you know, because she's sitting on the little exam table and I'm sitting on a little chair in front of it. And I said, well, honestly, you know, she'd said something about her niece. And I said, I'm very sorry that you went through that with your niece. I said, but I just want you to know that on the flip side of this, if I give my daughter access to all of these things and she ultimately ends up wanting to kill herself anyway, I feel like I've just rolled out the rainbow carpet, the glitter carpet for her to do it on. And I can't. So at some point, the pediatrician was asking her some questions that were, you know, I don't know, like about her relationship. She had a boyfriend at the time, and she's asking some questions. And I'm thinking maybe my daughter's not super comfortable answering these questions with mom in the room.
Sure. She's 15, right? That's a hard line. Yeah.
You know, and like, there's a part of me that's like, no sex until you're like 100, because like, I just know how vulnerable people can be when they're young and they don't know a lot of things. But I'm also aware that it's likely that these things, some things have likely occurred, and we talk about safe sex practices and all that jazz. So, but I leave the room and let her talk with the pediatrician. But by the time I come back, I get called back into the room. When I go in, my daughter is just like tragically, devastatingly upset. like sobbing, crying, like puffy, rashy face crying. And I'm like, what in the hell happened between when I left and when I came back? And the pediatrician was super smug. And she
said, and this is the same pediatrician that you have had for a long time. You have a long-standing relationship with.
Long.
Like, I just want to keep that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so this woman had a practice 15 minutes down the road from me, and I hated the place where she practiced. Like, I loved her. I hated everything about everything else at this entire place. And finally, one day I said to her, I said, I don't want to leave you, but I may have to find another pediatrician because I can't stand this place and these people. They were just so negative and so rude, and just like they were doing you a favor by charging you $1 million in nano minutes to be in their office, you know? And she says, well, what I'd like you to do in about 6 weeks is I would like you to call and make an appointment to see me. And when they tell you, we're really sorry, Dr. So-and-so isn't here anymore, and you're going to ask them, well, where did she go? And they're going to tell you, we can't tell you. But then you're going to hang up and you're going to call your insurance company and you're going to say, hey, I tried to make an appointment with Dr. So-and-so. Where can I find her? And they'll let you know where I've gone. And then you can come to see me. So I do this thing 6 weeks later, and I call to get the appointment, and I call the insurance company, and I get the appointment. She is now like an hour away from where I live, but it is worth it to me to travel an hour to see her versus staying local where, I mean, there's a pediatrician on every corner of all of the surrounding cities where I live. So
but that's how much you valued her as a medical professional and as maybe even a friend a little bit, you know?
Like somebody that, and she went through my whole pregnancy with me basically because I was taking the kids that I nannied to see her while I was pregnant. So, I mean, she's been there since ground zero, since before ground zero. So, so to have her, when I walk back in that room, standing there so smug with her arms crossed across her chest, and she's leaning against the exam table where my daughter is hysterically crying. And I say, oh my gosh, what happened? Are you okay? What's going on? And the pediatrician glares at me and looks at her, and she says, can I tell her? And my daughter just looks like confused and terrorized at this point, you know, can I tell her? And she says, I don't know what you mean. And so the pediatrician leaned down and whispered something in her ear. And my daughter's like, yeah, it's okay. She says, do you know that your daughter called a suicide hotline? And I had to take that in for a second. And I looked at my daughter. I said, wow, so this is really, really brave of you. It was really brave of you to make that call. I said, there are a lot of people in this world who wouldn't make that call. And they would stay in their pain and their suffering, and they might hurt themselves. And I said, and the fact that you did that is really brave. And I looked at the pediatrician and I said, no, we didn't. She didn't specifically tell me that she has called a suicide hotline. I said, I do know in working with her counselor that we have been dealing with some suicidal ideations at times. And we're working together as a team to help her get through that. But no, I wasn't specifically aware that she'd called a suicide hotline. It was at this time that her pediatrician said to me, she said, this is the last thing I'm going to say about this. She said, I just want you to know that if your daughter kills herself because you don't get her the help she needs for her gender dysphoria, if you don't get her affirming care and a gender counselor and she kills herself, you are going to feel awfully guilty. And I said, I am going to feel equally as guilty if she goes through this and still kills herself. And that's just the truth. There's no guarantee that giving her access to affirming care, hormones, or surgery would prevent a child from, or a young adult, or any person, mm-hmm. that it would prevent them from, you know, attempting or completing a suicide. There is not enough evidence to suggest that that's true. And there are plenty of young people who have gone through transgender-related care, medical transgender-related care, that have still felt suicidal afterwards. And there are people who have completed suicide after going through these interventions.
Yeah. In the film, some of the experts that we interview actually speak to that point. Some of the medical professionals talk about how those children with gender dysphoria are at an increased risk for suicide ideation. But on the flip side, other medical professionals say, yes, that's true, but medically transitioning them doesn't decrease that rate or decrease suicidality. So it's a really important point.
Well, and I think one of the craziest things is that this is the only mental or medical care condition that I am aware of where if especially a teenager or a young child threatens suicide, that what we do is affirm and assist. When I was an anorexic and I basically said, you know, if you make me eat and I start to gain weight, I'm just going to kill myself. You know, nobody was like, oh, well, gosh, now that she said that, maybe it's really okay that she's not eating 4 out of the 5 days of the, you know, regular week, and she's binging on the weekends and purging her food. Maybe we should just, you know, as a matter of fact, you could probably stand to lose another 3 or 4 pounds and be okay.
Yeah.
That's not how that happened. But for this particular condition, the solution is to offer very risky medical interventions to a person who is already like crying out for mental health care, because most of the time, because of co-occurring, you know, conditions, depression and other conditions.
In your story, both for the film and today, I heard you talk about your daughter really wanting testosterone, and that the counselors that you were seeing or had seen didn't really approve of this desire. Tell us about that. And I know in your interview, you said your daughter felt like she understood the risks. She'd done her research on the effects of testosterone in her body. So tell us about where she went for that research. Tell us about, has she done any medical transitioning to this point?
So as of right now, the biggest transition event for her, I think, was cutting off all of her hair. She had very long Rapunzel-esque hair, and she wanted it in a nice short haircut, which sort of broke my heart, only because I have like really bad hair. Okay. There was a comedian once, he was talking about how he didn't have that good hair like his siblings or his cousins did. He had really bad bank robbing hair, like the kind of hair that comes off your head at night and robs banks while you're sleeping. Right. So I feel like I've always had bank robber hair my whole life. And my daughter has like that beautiful Pantene Pro-V commercial style hair. And so even though she may not have appreciated it, I super appreciate it. Like, I may not have my own, but I half made that. And boom, look how awesome and stunning that is. So like a part of me was sad when she cut it all off, just because it looked so beautiful to me. But if she was truly more comfortable with a shorter haircut, like, it's her hair. Like, I gave her a little bit of a hard time because I was sad to see it go. But, you know, overall, I don't mind if she has different style tastes than I have. Like, it's just reality. You have to accept these things sometimes. So her biggest, I think, step towards transitioning so far was the haircut. And then, of course, she wants to go by the boy name and the pronouns. She also purchased a binder for herself.
That's a breast binder, right? That's what you're...
Yes, I'm sorry. A breast binder she could have a more a flatter chest. She has, since around 11 years old, she started developing and she did used to get some, you know, negative attention from boys or positive attention, depending on who you are and how you look at it. I mean, as a parent, you always see it negatively, but I think that even before she started to believe that she was a boy, she grew very tired very quickly of the attention that she was receiving around her breast, which, you know, she was a very small framed girl and she ended up with a very large chest very quickly. And so I often wonder if maybe the binder might not have been something she had wanted regardless of an identity, because she just wasn't super thrilled about that attention. But those are the furthest interventions that have happened. So we've stayed medical intervention free to this point. And thankfully, because we live in a state where the age of medical majority is 15 years old. So she could literally go to her pediatrician. She could go to not our most local Planned Parenthood, but one that's only about 30 minutes away. And she wouldn't need my help to have these interventions. And I don't know if she just doesn't know that, or if, in spite of knowing that, is still not willing to, I guess, disobey me to that degree. I don't know for sure how we've managed to avoid it so far, but we have. And when I get really super lost and frustrated and angry and sad about being in the middle of this fight, I try to remember to be grateful that we are at least not there. She is one of 7 girls in her group of friends who identifies as male. And 3 of those 7 girls are on T and have been testosterone and have been since they were 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of girls in her social group. that up. Do you, I've heard like people talk about this as kind of like a little bit of a social contagion, or, and that being a factor in the broader conversation around rapid onset gender dysphoria. Is there a status or popularity or anything to be gained from identifying as transgender, or what role in your opinion does friendships and the internet have to do with this or to do with your daughter?
So I think that this is very much like our anorexics from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, our kids who self-harmed and cut in the 90s and early 2000s. It seems that most social contagions happen to younger girls who are going through the very uncomfortable phase of their life, going through puberty, trying to find self-acceptance, acceptance of others. And this seems very classically and very stereotypically like the other social contagions that our girls have been through throughout the years. And it's very scary to, as a parent, see this, but then have the medical and mental health professionals tell you to disbelieve your own eyes, to disbelieve your own, you know, thoughts on this after having done any level of research on the social contagion factor of different mental health disorders throughout history, especially when it affects young girls. And I'm not saying that there aren't social contagions that affect young men, because there certainly are, but you will see historically and into present that they typically affect girls at a higher rate than they do boys.
Yeah.
I know when I was going through my eating disorder, we didn't have the internet yet. So there was little external information. I got most of my information from my peers and my other peers who were also starving themselves or you know, purging their food. We got information from each other. We were able to, if they're going to weigh you at your next appointment, you just roll up some coins and you put them in your pockets. Or if, you know, if you just push your food around your plate and make it look like you ate something, then, you know, people seem to be less likely to call you out for not eating. I mean, we got these tips from each other. And I'm assuming that my friends got it maybe from their friends or their family members, but it still got to us. I lived in a neighborhood that was all dirt roads and horse farms. It's not like we were in some epicenter of a city somewhere, you know? So, children will find these things out, especially teenage girls will find these things out from one another. And now with the addition of the internet, I mean, they have information at their fingertips in a matter of seconds. And they can share it with each other and pull it from the internet. And you have a whole host of grown adults inviting these children into this world and making them feel like these are positive, valid choices for them to make for themselves. And anybody who stands against them, you know, maybe doesn't care about them.
Yeah.
They what?
Or can't be trusted.
Yes. Yes. There's a huge level of distrust between my daughter and I now since all of this started happening. And all I've done from the very beginning is try to advocate for her to stay whole and healthy. And, you know, if as an adult, she chooses to do something different, then, you know, that's what she chooses. But as a child, I think that it's important for her to remain intervention free. I know that if I had had access to surgeries as a teenager, I would have, it was very different than her. I was very small and I wasn't well developed. Most of the girls in my school were all larger breasted than I was. So I would have had surgeries to have a tummy tuck, and I would have wanted to have implants, and I would have wanted to have like dental veneers. I didn't love my smile. Like there are all these things that I would have chosen to do that now as an adult, I'm really quite frankly glad that I didn't do any of those things because they weren't necessary. They weren't something that was going to make me a healthier person. But yes, she's been very stuck on wanting the testosterone since the beginning. And it seems to be her biggest preoccupation when she talks about wanting to transition. I mean, the thing she likes to talk about is she can't wait to go on testosterone. She can't wait to see how it changes her voice. She can't wait to see how it makes her muscles bigger and how it makes her body hairier and how it just makes her more her authentic self, because that's how she sees herself.
I mean, it sounds like I already have the answer to this question, but you don't think children can be making these lifelong decisions, because once that voice changes, it can't go back. It can't. In the film, we were able to interview a couple of detransitioners, and they talked to this effect that once they make these decisions, they can't go back. And we're not talking about adults. Adults can make their own decisions, right? If I want to go in for a breast augmentation next week, that's fine. I'm an adult. I'm capable. But as a child, do I really understand the decisions I'm making that can medically or can permanently change my body in a way that I may not understand.
So I think certainly not as a child. Absolutely. There is no way for a kid to really understand the long-term effects of taking a drug that could potentially and most likely will sterilize them. I mean, which one of us wanted children when we were 13 years old? You know, none of us wanted children at 13. There might've been that one girl or that one boy that was like, I can't wait to grow up and have a family. Right. But they were,
so I wanted five children, and all of my friends who are listening will know that I wanted them all to be with the name V, Veronica, Valerie, you know, whatever. But, and it's funny now cause I have no children, but see, I foster, but I don't have any biological children. Yeah.
Wow. And
so it's just interesting, right? Like, yes, I was probably that one girl in your group who wanted a whole family, but,
right.
And it changes our desires and our wants and our brains develop.
Yes. And when we went for something that, in my opinion, not that attention deficit disorder is not an important disorder, right? But when you compare attention deficit disorder to potential lifelong medical patient of transgender medicine, I feel like transgender medical care is probably the heavier of the two medical conditions, that if you're just weighing those two things against each other, and in order to even have an appointment to discuss whether or not my child might potentially have attention deficit disorder, everybody had to fill those packets out, right? I had to fill one out. She had to fill one out. The teachers, like, you know, other family members, so that they could get a complete picture of what everybody thought about her in this situation in order to give her the best care possible. But when she says, I think I'm a boy, there is no evaluation. There isn't a single, you're not even allowed to whisper a breath of resistance. And I don't understand that. How are we going to provide these children with best evidence-based care if we can't study it, we can't research it, we're not allowed to talk about it, nobody's allowed to question it? And I thought one of the biggest things in the medical and mental health community was to question the therapies that we are developing for people to make sure that they pass rigorous standards, that they are the best gold standard approaches for us to be able to use. But this one condition seems to get to circumvent all of those stopgaps that were put into place for all of the other situations and issues. And I too am friends with some detransitioners. They were adult transitioners. They were 25, 26 years old when they started their medical journey. And when they asked questions, when they were scared that maybe they weren't making the right choice, they were told by their medical care team that this is fine. We have a solution for that. We can help you. There's, you know, there isn't anything that's going to happen that we're not going to be able to help you with. But then as it turned out, that wasn't true. And these people did experience negative side effects and negative consequences. And when they would try to tell their medical care team, oh my God, this is happening to me, where's that help that you said that would be here for me? And they're like, oh, well, you know, it's really unusual that that's happening to you, or that didn't happen to anybody else. Or, I mean, we're going to do our best, but we can't guarantee. And that's when a lot of these people realized, oh my God, I've been sold a lie. The very same drug that they are using as a puberty blocker for teenagers, for, you know, children and teenagers to help block puberty, Lupron, is a drug that they also give to women who are receiving fertility treatment. And a friend of mine who went through IVF treatment in order to have her child was told, like, hands down, all of the risks associated with taking Lupron in order to help with her fertility. I mean, they, no bars held. And this was 17 years ago, 18 years ago when she started that journey. And it really, really was like scary. They made it very clear, like, all of these really bad negative things could happen to you. So you need to be fully well prepared that if you go down this route, these are the possible outcomes. And we still can't even guarantee that you're going to have a child, you know? And that's a lot of pressure. But she's a grown woman going through this. She was in her 30s and she really, really wanted to have a child. So they were going to give it a try. And they went through their course of therapy and she did end up having, you know, a very healthy child, and all went well for her for the most part, she did suffer some negative side effects, but nothing compared to what she was told could happen. But enough that she decided one was good. She wasn't going to do that again. She'd kind of been through enough. But this very same drug that they're marketing to our children off-label for a condition they weren't meant to treat, their parents are being told that it is safe. The children are being told that it is safe. And they will give you the scary, you know, outcomes that are possible, but they minimize so much what those possible outcomes are. And like they said to my other friend, you know, when she was going through her transition, you know, we can help you with that. We have a solution for that. This doesn't happen that often. You know, most people are generally okay. And no, how can that same drug that is so dangerous for a grown woman to take suddenly be safe for pediatric care? And so my daughter's research that she did on the topic of Lupron, she watched some YouTube videos from some transitioners that were very happy with their transition. And while my daughter understands there could be negative consequences, she feels that she's generally really healthy. So why would any of these negative consequences happen to her? That was her level of research at that time, at that conversation that I was aware of. And I was like, okay, let me pull up the Lupron insert for you. If you were to get this medication at your doctor, this is the insert that comes with that medication. And here are all of the potential side effects that could happen to you. And it doesn't matter whether you're healthy or not. And not to mention, this medication has not been studied for use in pediatric patients for the purpose of blocking puberty.
Right. There's no long-term studies on these things and what could be done to these children.
I have a friend who has a daughter who is developmentally disabled and physically disabled. And there was discussion about putting her on a puberty blocker when she was younger because she would not be able to take care of herself in a capacity that if she started her menstrual cycle, it would have had to have been a family member or a healthcare provider that would have taken care of those things for her. But after my friend had read about the potential side effects of Lupron, she says, we'll figure it out. We're just going to let her go through puberty if she goes through puberty, and we're not going to do this to her because it seems horrible.
The risk wasn't worth it to them.
Right.
Yeah. Has your opinion, you've been on this journey with your daughter for quite some time now. Has your opinion on transgenderism changed since walking through this with her?
Yes, immensely. So when I was in my younger 20s, I had a friend who was female to male trans identified. I don't know that we even really called it that yet. You know, we knew this person, we'll call her Sam, that Sam had, you know, through high school had been female and was Samantha. And then as she grew older, she started to go by Sam, which is a very like generic name to begin with anyway, you know, but then, you know, she wanted to cut her hair and she wanted to wear boys' clothes. And she became very interested in possible alterations and medications that would help her be more of a guy. And I never had any problem with this. I was very supportive of her. Which if my daughter could hear me now, she'd be, why do you constantly misgender him? But I knew Sam as a her until Sam changed her presentation. And it's difficult for me to have known her whole life one way and then to think of her being someone else. Now, if you met Sam in real life today, I don't think you would say to yourself, I'm meeting a young woman. You would think that you were meeting a young man. She's had a very successful transition. And I was very super supportive of all of the steps and the measures that she went through to feel like her outsides matched her insides. What I didn't realize when I was being so supportive was that we were teaching Sam that she would be better as a man than as a woman, that nobody stopped to think what has happened that has caused Sam to feel that she can no longer be female. And I don't think it was addressed on a mental health level. I don't think it was addressed on a medical health level. And, you know, Sam is now, as far as I know, she has had a double mastectomy. I don't know that she's had any other interventions besides testosterone and a double mastectomy, but it's crazy to me that I say to myself, oh, she only had testosterone and a double mastectomy. Like these are no big deal, right? But I think being in this space for so long and seeing how far this all really goes for some people, that does seem like a smaller tragedy than going through testosterone, a double mastectomy, and then possibly a full or partial hysterectomy, and then maybe going on to having some level of phalloplasty, you know? But yeah, my view has changed so much because I started to realize that this is a movement that seeks to tell people that there's something wrong with them and that they need medical intervention that is going to be very costly and very dangerous. And we're convincing them so deeply that there's something wrong with them that they're willing to sign themselves up for those dangerous interventions. And there's nothing that will convince me that it is better to push that direction than to try and help a person resolve whatever their disconnect is, to help support them. You can be a woman and not shave your legs. You can be a woman and not ever wear a dress. You can be whatever type of woman you want to be and still be a woman. And that is okay. And we're going to love you and we're going to support you. But the moment that people start telling you, oh, well, if you don't do this thing, you're not a real woman. You must be a man. That's a level of misogyny that I can't even wrap my head around. I just can't.
I have a hard time as well. So what would you say to other parents who might have children with gender identity confusion or gender dysphoria?
That's a big one. And I'm going to start with, even before you have a child that's old enough to have the possibility of gender dysphoria or gender confusion, when you're pregnant for the first time, with the first one, and you're interviewing pediatricians, you probably remember, like, you have friends that have given birth, and you probably are familiar with that time and space where you're interviewing pediatricians, you're getting to know them, you're super excited, because they're going to be the person, one of the first people besides you to take care of your baby. And they're supposed to grow with your child basically the same amount of time you're growing with your child. So it's, you're in for a big commitment for 18 years. So when you're having those really important, like, first-time mommy interviews of the pediatrician, I think it's really important to ask these tough questions, and maybe not in the whole group in front of the other parents, but if you're able to talk to the pediatrician separately or even in the group, I think it's really important to ask them. And you may feel ridiculous, and the doctor may look at you like you have sprouted two heads and are speaking a foreign language. But I think it's really important to get a gauge of how your pediatrician feels about access to transgender medical interventions for pediatric patients. Because we are living in a world where it is being very, very normalized from, you know, kindergarten on. It's a very normalized thing. So we're going to start seeing more and more children wanting access at younger and younger ages. And if the parents are unaware, if they're caught unaware like I was when their child is a teenager, I mean, you've lost the battle before it started, honestly. By that point, if your child does desist from a different gender identity, it's only going to be because of the experiences that they go through that are going to lead them back to their original self in whatever capacity they can go back. So it's really important to be aware of this very young. And if you have a teenager who is like my daughter, where out of the clear blue nowhere starts with a new identity, I think it's really, really important to stick to your own guns and to say, you know, these are the things I can accept. These are the things that I can't accept. Even when the school pushes back, even when the pediatrician pushes back, even when her friend's parents push back and family members push back, because everybody is going to try to push back. Everybody is going to try to tell you that you're wrong and you're on the wrong side of history and that you're abusing your child by not giving into this ideology. But if you know your child and you know that this might not be the right choice for them, you know them better than any of these other people do, especially as parents. And it isn't hateful to want the best for your child, the best medical care, the best mental health care. And the gold standard used to be the least interventions you had, the better the quality of care. And we need to try to find a way to get back to that. But I would also say that these parents need to find support, people who do agree with them and see reality. And even if it's just one online group or one real friend in real life, but there are groups that are available for parents. I have an email address where if parents ever do need to reach out if they want somebody. I have a whole network of places. Most of the groups that I'm associated with are super uber private because we need to screen every member that we let in, because oftentimes what happens is our groups will get overrun by infiltrators that seek to take us down. But I have an email address of gendercriticalhumans@gmail.com. So it's just gendercriticalhumans, all spelled out normally, @gmail.com, where parents can reach out to me. And I don't check the email every day. I maybe check it once a week. But if there are parents who just don't have anywhere else that they can think to turn, I have a really, really big network of people that I can, you know, direct parents to. There's also a brilliant website, Fourth Wave Now. And I'm trying to think of any of the other resources that sort of led me to finding other critically thinking people, because it seems that that's the component that is missing the most in all of this is critical thinking skills. You know, when you can say that trans women are women, but we can't define what a woman is, there's a lack of critical thinking that is existing. And the people who are promoting that are the same people who are running our children's schools and their daycares and their classrooms and their school health rooms. And in often cases, their pediatricians. And even if a lot of these people don't agree with the narrative, they would risk losing their jobs if they did anything other than the affirmative approach. So you have to really, you need to know your care team, and you need to network with your friends and your family. And this is something that parents need to start thinking about, you know, when their kids are really, really little, the same way that we think about, you know, maybe what area we want to live in to make sure that our kids are able to go to the best schools and that our kids are able to grow up in a safe neighborhood. This is now a part of that, like, very beginning stages of planning your family, as far as I'm concerned, because it is the most insidious thing that I can think of, is to tell a child that there's something so inherently wrong with them that they need to surgically or chemically change themselves.
You read my mind, because my follow-up question was going to be that it seems like finding support is hard, and how can parents or others, aunts, uncles, go to for support if they don't want to go the route of puberty blockers and hormones. So thank you for providing those resources. We'll be sure to include them in the description of this podcast for people who might be listening if they want to reach out.
There's also Partners for Ethical Care. There's a website and a Facebook group, and I think they're also on Twitter. They are a fantastic resource for parents who are questioning the affirmative only approach.
And like I said, we'll include all of those in the description. We are getting close to our wrap up here and ending our time together. Is there anything else that you would like to say or tell youth who might be listening, who might be struggling, or parents or lawmakers or anyone that might be listening? Is there anything else that you'd like to say, Bren?
Oh, geez, that's a lot of pressure, but no, I will say, I really truly feel that no child is born in the wrong body. You know, we all have the body that we have and the personalities that we have, and we're allowed to have both of those things together without being told that we're flawed or we're wrong or we're broken or we're different or we need fixing. You know, and I want parents to know that there are going to be times, if you were going through this, there are going to be times that you're going to want to say, I just don't want to lose my kid. Maybe if I just give in, maybe if I just give up and give in, maybe I can repair this relationship with my child. And some people, that's what they need to do or want to do. And I don't know, my daughter may come to a point where she doesn't ever want to speak to me again. That could be a thing that happens. This is a real reality for a lot of parents that are in this, that their child leaves at some point, doesn't come back, and doesn't speak to them. I know a ton of parents who have been abandoned by their children. And it's such a backwards thing to say, but it's really what has happened. These children have left their parents, not the other way around, and can be very, very lonely. And I can completely understand wanting to give in to, as you said, harmless things like pronouns, but an intervention leads to an intervention leads to an intervention. And it's really, really important that we try to I guess, tough love these kids, to really love them, to be the people that are willing to stand up and speak the truth, even though we're being told that we're telling lies. We're not. We are telling the truth, and we can still love our children and disagree with their decisions. It's been happening since the dawn of time. Parents and children don't always agree on things, and that doesn't make a parent hateful just for disagreeing. Sometimes the reason we're disagreeing is because we love them more than they're capable of loving themselves.
Well, thank you for that, Bryn, and thank you for sharing your story. You can hear more about Bryn's story, and you can hear from other parents and medical experts by watching our new film, Transmission: What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? Bryn, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me and taking time out of your busy week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing and all the things that you've done, and for giving parents a voice, for giving us a space that we can come together and find one another and talk about reality.
That's our goal here, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage everyone to think beyond the masses. Thank you to all of our listeners. Hope you have an excellent day.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.